What's up, everyone? Welcome to Hollywood Unveiled, where we pull back the curtain on the Hollywood film industry and share untold stories from the unsung heroes behind the scenes. Everyone knows about the directors, writers, and actors, but what about the script supervisor, or the editor, or gaffer? All of these departments have come together to bring the films you love to life. I'm Jake.
And I'm Logan.
How you doing, Logan?
I'm doing good. You know, it's been pretty chill day. We're kind of dating ourselves with this, but it is the day of the hurricane, so you know, it's a very relaxed day. Haven't had any power outages or anything, so just been
not
kind
foreboding
of watching movies
at
for
all
the day. No, not ominous in the least,
right? Same here. Yeah, we're sitting inside waiting for this hurricane to pass. It hasn't been too bad, just a little mild rain right now. No power outages where I am. Yeah. But yeah, I'm excited to talk about some movies and the industry and what we do, what you do, what and how we do it. So you and I, we work in the film industry. I work in visual effects and you work in practical makeup effects.
Correct. Yes.
Tell me a little bit about your journey here and how did you get into this business?
Well, I got started back in 2012. I graduated from college and was coming out here, and I was one of the few people at my college to actually want to be involved in makeup effects. Everyone else was like, oh, I want to direct or I want to produce. And I was like, I want to make creatures. Like, that was a really fun element of it to me. So mm-hmm. I moved out here and started interning for American Makeup and Effects. Mm-hmm. Did effects work for a few films like The Call with Halle Berry and Haunted House 2 with Marlon Wayans. And at some point while kind of working there, my boss needed help with a zombie project that had kind of been tossed his way. Someone came up and was like, hey, I need effects for this. And he
oh, man, everybody's doing zombie movies.
I know. Well, especially back in 2013.
Yeah.
So everyone, you know, so he was really, you know, he was a bit overloaded. He didn't feel like he had the energy to kind of do this zombie project. So he kind of tossed it over to me. And well, that was actually the first time where I met you, because that project was, yeah, it was a 935, a zombie Nazi series or a Nazi zombies. I don't know what order you had it in for the title.
Oh, me neither. It's OK.
But doing the effects for that was really, really fun. Like, it was a chance to kind of fully get on set and kind of make these really dynamic characters and creatures. And I mean, from there, I was just in. I was having a ton of fun making these different monsters. And I mean, you know, did a few more things after that. But that was really what kind of kicked off the journey and got me really started practically doing a lot of these makeup effects.
Oh, man. And I remember working with you guys on that, and everything you and the entire team did was really phenomenal for the amount of money we didn't have to shoot. So,
well, and I think that's part of what makes good makeup effects, at least for mm-hmm. me personally. Like, there's this thing of you have however little a budget you do, and you still have to help bring that vision to life. So even with a shoestring budget, you know, you look at things like The Evil Dead, where it's like they had a budget of like $20 to make these wild effects. And a lot of them still look really fun because you can see the ingenuity that had to go in to kind of crafting these things and really kind of, you know, cementing that vision that the director had.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And speaking to that, ingenuity, when you don't have the resources to do everything you want, somewhere in there is where the art lies. And that's where yeah. you get the beauty of it. You know, if Steven Spielberg had every resource he wanted, we'd see Bruce the Shark in every single shot of Jaws. Right.
Exactly. But all of a sudden the animatronic doesn't work. Exactly. And now you have to start. OK, we have to use it very sparingly and we have to cut mm-hmm. it out here and only show glimpses. And it elevates the movie and kind of puts mm-hmm. it at that upper echelon that I think mm-hmm. a lot of people consider it now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to that point about what you have and what you don't have, I mean, when I met Dean, who brought you onto the film that we were working on, it really was a case of, like, I was doing visual effects for a film he directed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it really is, hey, everybody trying to make what you can with what you don't have. And he had X amount of shots and he had X amount of dollars and that would not necessarily cover all the shots. And, hey, it was a really cool scenario where we worked out a deal where, okay, well, I'll do your visual effects. I'll do all your visual effects for a majorly discounted rate. And he provided the makeup. He provided the team and the makeup, obviously, to do the makeup for my film. And so it's a really cool, you know, sort of a barter system going on in the industry and everybody getting stuff done together. And, you know, it's a win-win for everybody. You know, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. So how about you? What got you kind of involved in the industry and got you started kind of down the path of visual effects?
I'm originally from Hawaii, and I was very fortunate. I had a lot of really great mentors who promoted creativity and were like really getting me into inspired to do film. And one of them was a local radio DJ. He was a local celebrity DJ, Cupmaster Spaz. And he was offered a TV show by the local Time Warner station, and they wanted him to host something, but also produce it and create and all that. So he took a chance on this young, dumb, naive 19-year-old kid with a camera and some editing software and said, "Hey, you want to direct a TV show for Time Warner?" And I was like, sure. And so we shot something over 200 episodes. The first 50 or so were on a weekly basis, and nobody told us we could have season breaks. So it was just week after week after week of week. It was a magazine style show where it was a lot of interviews. Mm-hmm. And, but it was also, we weaved in sketch comedy throughout the whole thing. So it gave me this excuse to do really just, really dumb stuff on TV. and
sometimes dumb is the best stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And but like in that process, also doing a little bit of visual effects here, a little bit of visual effects there. But later, I then later went to film school in LA, over at the Musicians Institute of Technology in Hollywood, California. That's where I took their film program. And then I really got really immersed in music video making and visual effects here and there, a little bit with After Effects. I mean, it's a very long story of bouncing back and forth between LA and Hawaii. And then I finally moved to LA like permanently after that. And I didn't have a job. And one day somebody emailed me through Craigslist. Now we have all these various, you got Fiverr, you've got all these sites where you can get jobs and everything. But I was found on Craigslist by somebody who wanted me to do a quick pitch video where, you know, it's like, hey, he has an idea for a movie. I'll do some motion graphics and to kind of sell it, make a fake trailer for it. And he really liked it, or he hired me to do it. Didn't know who he was, and turned out to be Darren Bousman, who directed Saw 2, 3, and 4, Repo, yep. The Genetic Opera. At the time, this is what he already had under his belt. And since then, we had a pretty good working relationship. He brought me on to work on his film 11-11-11. He made me the VFX guy at that point, which was kind of cool. Then he brought me on to The Devil's Carnival. And so it kind of just, I was trying to find work as a director, editor, whatever I could, but then I just kind of found myself in visual effects and then really accidentally fell into it. And it just kind of became something I was kind of good at. And then I got better at and better at, better at over a series of movies. And now that's what I do. I run a company with my wife, and we make VFX for movies, TV, and whatnot. So.
Nice. So would you say it was that work with Darren that kind of initially sparked your interest in VFX and made you kind of pursue that as a career? Or was it a particular project that you did in and around that time that really kind of pushed you towards it?
I wouldn't say it inspired the VFX, because that was, I looked at VFX as just another tool under my belt, because when you come out to LA, you can say, I'm an editor. Okay, there's a million editors out here. How are you going to get work as an editor? Well, if I'm going to get work as an editor, I should at least know how to do some motion graphics, or like if you want to say, I'm a director. Okay, definitely. Who's going to just be like, you haven't done anything here. Who, you know, so, you know, you need to have like 12 things under your belt to compete with anybody. So VFX became one of those things that I was super interested in. Yes. But it also was like, kind of like, okay, well, this will help me get the job, that if I can do this, I know how to do After Effects really well. So I wouldn't say it sparked the interest in VFX. I mean, like, I think that was inadvertently sparked when I got into magic back as a kid, you know? So, and then watching all the behind the scenes documentaries on Discovery Channel, Movie Magic, that sort of thing, where everything was, hey, guess what? Practical. you know, and or composite of practical, you know, like you're still doing visual effects, but you're using practical elements to do it, you know, like, I mean, well, hey, that's your world, man. You know all about that.
Yeah.
How about you? I mean, like I said, speaking of movie magic, did you watch those shows too?
I did. Well, actually, what really kind of started my interest in makeup effects, was my dad. So when I was growing up, I was a big old scaredy cat, you know, like I think a lot of kids, like there were a lot of movies that I couldn't really watch because they would freak me out, you know, like The Witches with Angelica Houston, like, you know, seeing her pull off her face and seeing that whole transformation, freaky as all get out. But the one like kind of scary movie that I could watch, were the Universal monster movies, you know, so like your Lon Chaney Jr., your Boris Karloff, your Bela Lugosi, like, and I really found myself liking the Wolfman. That was a really cool character. I liked the design of this thing. And I thought that was really cool. And then there was one Halloween that I came home and American Werewolf in London was on TV. Oh, and my dad was like, oh, you know, he likes werewolf stuff. So he left it on and it was right at the big transformation scene. Mm. And even seeing that on like, you know, AMC or A&E or TNT or whatever it was at the time, the visuals of this werewolf transformation freaked me out so intensely. Mm-hmm. So it took years, honestly, for me to even be able to go back and rewatch the movie. I remember there was a couple times where like we'd rent it from Blockbuster and I would get home and I would start playing it and I would hilariously get to the scene where like leading up to that first transformation, where David's kind of walking around the house and he's like, you know, oh, I'm not hungry. Like, and just the anticipation of like, I know this big transformation is coming. I know it's going to scare the hell out of me. And I couldn't deal with it. I couldn't process. So I'd always kind of turn off the movie before it got to that point. And then because we had the DVD, I looked into the bonus features and there was a whole featurette on how Rick Baker did the Change-O hand. Because he made a lot of different things that he called change-o pieces, where you would have the understructure of kind of whatever the piece is with a thin skin over it. And then the inner mechanism would like grow and change and it would look like, you know, like for the transformation. Like, yeah, like his hand is growing or his face is stretching out or his back. Mm-hmm. And it was literally just a featurette on them molding his arm so they could build one of those change-o arms. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated. The fact that this movie that was really just like it was just plaster and latex and just like different materials. The fact that those could get such a visceral response out of me and leave me feeling as terrified as I was, you know, after I watched that featurette, I kind of went, I was able to finally go in and legit just watch the movie. Ah. And after finishing it, like, I was like, that was amazing. Like seeing the, you know, once I kind of saw how, you know, how the sausage made.
Yeah, I was going to say you needed to know how it worked so you could actually watch it. Same here. You know, as a kid, I was scared of everything too. Like, I don't know if you were scared of everything, but I was scared of so many movies where I was like, nope, can't watch it, too scared. Yeah. But it, if you know how it works, when I was scared to watch Beetlejuice, but my mom told me, well, you know, that's just Batman, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, it is? That's the same guy playing Batman? Oh, I can watch Beetlejuice now. You know, it was like really little.
Yes. But yeah, so once I kind of knew how the sausage was made for it, like it opened up this whole new world of like, oh, well, if that's just, you know, this kind of more elaborate version of make-believe, like what else can this do? And from there, I started really getting into it. So anytime I would rent a DVD, like I would watch all of the bonus features before I even watched the movie. And I got really into seeing just how all of these elements kind of came about. So when I went to college, like everybody else was like learning how to be a director of photography or learning to be a writer. And I was, you know, taking those same classes. But I was really like, I want to learn the makeup effects. I want to learn how to do that. And it let me kind of carve out a little niche because at my college, not a lot of people were pursuing the makeup aspect of it. Mm-hmm. So my junior year, a buddy of mine was doing a project and he was like, it's a horror movie. I need this girl to be, she's captured by a serial killer and then kind of dissected. And there's a lot of gore effects. And he's like, I have no idea how to do it. So I need someone who can help me figure it out. And I was like, well, like, let me give this a go. Let me see if I can figure out how to put this whole thing together. And from there, it just kind of, you know, it went off. Like, I was able to kind of keep doing that for a lot of other projects. And it worked really well for me. And, you know, that allowed me to then come out here and kind of get that internship where I met you. Mm-hmm. And really kind of get me going.
That is awesome, man. Now, when you talk about the practical elements and the things that scare us, one of the things that comes to mind in the practical world is the movie The Fly. And I had just recently rewatched that. But when I was a kid, I was supposed to be in bed. My parents were watching the movie in the living room. And the scene that got me was the scene where he breaks his arm. And yes. Break in the arm wrestling. And that one, like I said, I was sneaking out. I was looking around the corner. Ooh, I'm going to watch this movie. My parents said I can't watch. Ha ha. I'm going to watch from back here. They won't even know I'm here. And he breaks the guy's arm wrestling. And all my parents here in the background is, from behind the room. And I was into, I was like, oh my God, what was that? And looking back now, I'm like, well, I mean, it looked kind of real, you know, like it looked pretty real. But to think about all the work that goes into just a single moment like that.
Yes.
And they have to build these big mechanical pieces for something that is going to be in for half a second. And
yes.
And that is something very similar to like what I do digitally now, where we are, you know, you put in hours and weeks on a single shot sometimes. And I mean, like it's really just deferred time. Technically, you'll put that time up front. I'll be in post-production doing it, you know, and sometimes that's where the producers don't know if they want to spend the money ahead of time or in the post-production, or like they say, that good old fashioned saying, just fix it in post. You know, that one's wonderful. Isn't that your favorite too? Well,
the whole sentiment of like a fix it in post, like there's this great quote. I want to say it's from John Carpenter and I might be wrong on this, but like he talks about how you have to be an exceptionally talented filmmaker to shoot with practical effects, because practical effects only look good from certain angles, in certain lighting, and, you know, in certain aspects. So most of the people who go, I'll just fix it in post, they just want to shoot the shot that they want and don't want to kind of compromise and go, oh, OK, well, we need to take that effort on the front end to set up the shot how we need it to. Instead, they'd rather go, well, I'm just going to shoot what I want to shoot, and then I'll let it get, quote unquote, fixed in post, and then let someone, like, you know, digitally add a thing in. And it's like, all right, well, sometimes that really can work. And sometimes it leaves you kind of wanting more, because you're like, ah, well, like, this isn't a well composited shot. And that is at no fault of the visual effects artist. But it's, you know, it's like, well, it's really overly lit. Well, that's because you didn't have the thing there on set to actually film with it and know, oh, this is how the shadows would play, you know, for something like The Fly. You know, when Goldblum is all kind of mutanted out and he looks really weird, like he casts different shadows. The lighting plays differently with his deformed skin. So it looks very different, and it does things almost on accident that it would be very difficult for a digital artist to recreate, because there's no way you could know that it would do that without seeing it there on set in person.
Yeah. And, you know, that kind of brings me to practical versus digital. I mean, it's not in the sense of like, oh, one is better than the other, or when was it like, you know, when they should have done this, should have done that. I mean, you know, we could have that conversation all day long, but amazing marriage of the two when they're done right.
Yeah. I mean, look at the finale of The Fly. Sorry for, you know, listeners for spoiling a movie that came out in 1986, but the very end of the movie, he has this full transformation where, you know, the rest his skin kind of sloughs off and he is now this like half man, half fly creature. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee if you were to be making that movie now, that whole final form would be a digital creation.
Mm-hmm.
like there's no way it would be done practically. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it, at least for me, because you know, you listed The Fly, like that is honestly one of my favorite effects movies.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Like whenever I'm like, you know, makeup effects, like, you know, is that something that I still really love? I watched that movie, and the fact that I still can't see the seams on anything, I'm like, oh, damn, that's a really good makeup. OK, yes, I do really like this. So it's the usage of it as a practical, just big puppet there mm-hmm. at the end of the movie is really what sells the tangibility of this character there in the scene.
Talking about The Fly and how he just tears out of his legs and everything, like that transformation. Yeah. Both The Fly and The American Werewolf in London, you actually see both of those inspiring the digital work done in Van Helsing for their werewolf transformation. Because if you remember, The American Werewolf in London was probably one of the first where they showed how violent the transformation was, yes. right?
Well, because prior to that, if you're looking back at like the Chaney Wolfman, it mm-hmm. was basically a time lapse. Like you would mm-hmm. have your actor in front of the camera and you would shoot a little bit of footage, and then you would have a little bit of the make, you would add a little bit of the makeup mm-hmm. to him, and then you would crossfade between those two.
It was just
shots.
cross dissolve.
It almost yeah. felt really peaceful. Because those old movies, you see, he literally just sits in an easy chair, and all of a sudden his face just slowly shifts into this monstrous form.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He gets up and he's a monster. But American Werewolf was the first time where it's like, no, like every bone in your mm-hmm. body is breaking and reforming. This is going to be painful. And you can get a real performance mm-hmm. out of your actor because you're giving them more to work with mm-hmm. with these kind of violent transformations.
You know, there's also these stages in filmmaking and developing technology where we have to go through these movies where it wasn't great CG. Every now and then you have a Scorpion King with The Rock coming out and it doesn't look great. And then you have something like Jar Jar Binks.
No. Like what I appreciate with a character like Jar Jar, because, yeah, everyone looks to that as, oh, he's a fully digital kind of character. Most people don't realize that, like, Ahmed Best was like not only physically there on set, but like from I think like the collarbone down, he was in full makeup and costume.
They had originally intended to just replace his head.
We want him to be more animated, more lively.
But that's one that everybody wants to point at and be like, look at that CG, you know. But also, you have to have a Jar Jar Binks to get anywhere close to, say, Avatar, you know.
Yeah.
And so you have these stepping stones in film history of taking these big leaps, but then you have a lot of people, you could say, overusing VFX, but it's that sometimes that overusage kind of has to happen so we can get somewhere like an Avatar, or we have to try to jump the uncanny valley in yes. order to get somewhere, right?
And that's, I think, like Jurassic Park is a really good example, because people don't realize that like 90%, I think, of the shots with the dinosaurs mm-hmm. are practical.
Oh,
like,
yeah, the animatronics, you know. Yes.
Yes, like you look at the big sequence with the T-Rex, right? Mm-hmm. Like, of course, the scenes where you can see the full-size T-Rex running after them, clearly that's fully digital. But mm-hmm. the shots where, you know, the kids have the flashlight and you see the pupil dilate.
Oh, yeah.
Or the teeth kind of come down next to it. That's just a gigantic animatronic puppet. Mm-hmm. And that sells the full digital creature so much more than if he was digital from the get-go.
Oh, yeah.
Because you give your actors something to legitimately play against. Like, there's mm-hmm. there's that story of Ian McKellen on, I think it was The Hobbit, where, like, he's shooting a scene where Gandalf is sitting around this table.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And there's not a single other actor in the shot, and he's just performing against, you know, tennis balls and screens. And at one point he just breaks down crying because he's like, I'm an actor and there's nobody here for me to act against. I'm acting in a vacuum. And it's like, and while that is, you know, it is kind of, you know, a sad story to hear from McKellen, it shows that it's like having these tangible things that an actor can latch onto
mm-hmm.
really helps, because the actor is the big thing that carries the audience through the story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a lot of the other departments that help kind of set the canvas, but the actor is the one who's
working the paintbrush, and he's kind of guiding, you know, and he or she is kind of guiding the audience through this story. And if you give them a physical thing to play against, that's really where the audience now feels, oh my God, like they're clearly like actually seeing this thing and actually interacting with it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how would I be feeling if that thing was actually there? Whereas, you know, if it's a fully digital creature and you can kind of tell it's a fully digital creature, there is that bit of a divide where you're like, I mean, yes, clearly like the creature might look terrifying, but that uncanny valley, you can kind of go, ah, well, I can kind of tell this thing is a digital creature, so I don't feel as intensely about what's there on screen. So it's got to be done well. Like, you really have to know your stuff with kind of doing these digital versus practical kind of things. And
And I think there's an interesting gap being filled there with things like, say, the volume. Some argue that maybe it's being used a little too much these days. But I mean, they also said that about like green screen, CGI at all. I mean, like you could always make that argument about any new technology. But I also still feel that it's not the technology, it's how it's used.
Exactly.
With something like the volume, you are giving actors something to actually look at, something to actually react to. With that in mind, you're front loading your VFX to pre-production now. So there's something that a lot of people don't think about. They want to do that.
Yeah.
But you know,
I do think that also kind of brings it back to what we were talking about earlier with that Carpenter quote, where it's like, if you're using the volume, you are taking into account that, okay, this this shot has to be filmed a certain way because we need the volume to do to do this particular thing. So it's filmmakers kind of taking the reins back and taking it away from the, I will fix it in post. I mean, if you're using the volume, you can't really, like, you still technically can fix it in post.
But it's going to cost a lot of money. It means
you have to actually know what you're doing on the front end to set up the shots that you need, to set up the environment that works, to preload all of these different things to help your actors to convey that story to the audience.
It's a really interesting change in dynamic. When we were making films back in the 30s, as you and I personally, obviously.
Of course, I am 103 years old,
Oh, yes, exactly. You're shooting these Westerns on a rear projection where somebody's on the old wagon and everything. I mean, really, just building any set. You're committing to something physical that's gonna be there, right? And then there came a time where things are going a little more digital. Then you have your green screen, and you might have some pre-production, but then you know there's a lot of decisions you can make in post-production. And now it's kind of funny with the volume or any LED background. It's almost as if somebody said, "Hey, I got a wild idea. How about we plan ahead? We just work really hard at the beginning and figure it out before we get to the set, and then shoot the thing as if that's a brand new idea, right?" You know, you mean like we were back then too, but just with a different set of tools?
And I think that's really what it is that with the advent of CGI and using a lot of these green screens and blue screens, like we had a whole generation of like newer filmmakers kind of come up with that kind of thing of, okay, well, I can now imagine these big, wild things, and I don't have to nail down my vision for it until we finish filming.
And then there's we'll fix it in post. There's that.
Yes, which is, you know, as speaking as, you know, certainly from my department, and I know that you feel the same way, like the whole sentiment of, I will fix it in post, can only do so much.
Oh, sure,
I think a good example of this kind of thought process when it comes to, you know, these effects is, you know, we're circling back in Carpenter again. But The Thing. Because you look at the original The Thing, like, obviously, it's all practical. I think the only, like, digital shot in the movie is, like, the spaceship flying across the starfield at the beginning. Like, it's little effects.
Don't forget the computer model showing the cells merging with one another.
Showing the cell over to... but it's like... So clearly very tangible, very practical stuff. And you get a lot of these really dynamic, not only creatures, but camera setups, lighting, to showcase these big, monstrous creatures. And then you look at that compared to something like the prequel from 2011, And the story behind that movie was that they intentionally shot everything with practical effects. I think they went to Legacy Effects, I think is who did the practical stuff for it.
I think it was Amalgam.
It was Amalgam, one. Yes.
Yeah. Tom Woodruff Jr.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, yeah. And they built these beautiful creatures. And I use, beautiful because they got like tendrils and teeth. Oh, and stuff. Yeah. So, beautiful.
Artistically beautiful.
Yes, yes. And they build these wild creatures and then they do a test audience screening and everybody in the audience is like, this looks too much like an 80s movie. Mm. So Universal got scared and digitally erased all of the practical effects and then created fully digital from there. And it's wild because looking at a movie that the original is so dedicated to using these practical effects and using these kinds of really tangible creatures, to then seeing the prequel, it loses something. Mm-hmm. Especially if you're watching them back to back. You really can tell that it's like, something's different here.
Yeah.
It loses some of that pull.
Now, when I saw it quite a bit later, but knowing the story behind that, so I was super curious to see the prequel. And when I saw it, there were so many shots in there that were fully digital that I thought, this looks excellent. And it looks appropriate, and it was done well. Now, there was also, on the same token, there was a lot of shots there where it was 70-80% there. And it on a real technical level, the shots worked. I mean, I would personally have been proud to have done the shot myself.
Oh, of course. None of the effects look bad.
But they genuinely, they do stand out. And I think the movie itself falls a little victim to the third act green screen. A lot of movies, they front load all the great visual effects in the first two acts. And then for some reason, that last act fight, when it's a big visual effects display, I'm like, it looks like it was shot on the studio. It looks like it was shot on the green screen. And it doesn't always hurt, but sometimes it just genuinely stands out. So I think that the prequel to The Thing may suffer from that just a bit. But what I thought was really fascinating was I also went deeper. I looked at the visual effects breakdowns, and I was astonished at the level of work that was done with practical effects. And as you said, they just completely erased it. But if you just augmented it, as opposed to erase it and put something else over it, for a lot of these shots, just an augmentation, there are clearly plenty of shots where, yes, it does need to be fully CG. It does, to achieve that story effect that you want to do in this scenario, or necessary for the story you're telling too. So,
looking at something like what you mentioned, Avatar, to sell the skill, because the Na'vi, they are 9 feet tall or something that. They're these giant creatures, and what really sells those creatures is the fact that you have James Cameron shooting practical elements and then creating those characters digitally. So you can get this real sense of the scale of the characters and the intricacies of them because he's not fully crafting the scene wholesale from digital stuff. You have your building blocks, you have your template kind of starting with these practical things, but he knows the characters that he's creating and knows that they will work better as a digital creation.
I think it's really, really interesting you bring that up, because in The Way of Water, I saw that battle where the military's on these speedboats and everything. And I'm watching it thinking, I know there's so much visual effects going on here. And I'm thinking, I bet Cameron actually built these speedboats. And sure did. Sure did. Because on one hand, when there's all this visual effects, it's really hard to tell. You just start to assume, okay, everything's a visual effects in this shot. That the set too. Yeah, the set looks really real. Probably VFX. But in this case, he had so much that was real. What's really interesting is that these speedboats they built were something 2 or 3 times faster than anything that the military actually has. So the military now wants to buy them from James Cameron. So I think that's really fascinating.
But no, something else, especially talking with James Cameron, I think to go along with for lack of a better word, picking your battles. Knowing what works really well in digital versus practical. Look at Terminator 2.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the T-1000 is a character that needed to be CGI.
Mm-hmm.
The whole liquid metal thing, like, that, especially at the time, could not have been done practically. Mm-hmm. Especially in the way that he wanted to. Now, he does use practical elements, you know, like when the T-1000 makes these big blades, they would build a giant, like, sleeve that Robert Patrick could wear that would give him the big arm blade.
Let's not forget what they did with just rolling a little bit of mercury on the ground. You know, like, at the end scene where, I mean, like, that's a little, that's where a practical effect right there. Reforming and
coming back together. Yes, he knew what would work better with CG, what would work better practically, and finding the ways to combine those. Like, a movie that I have a soft spot for, and I know it's because of Rick Baker and my love of American Werewolf, but the remake of The Wolfman with Benicio del Toro. I love that is a full practical werewolf makeup.
Oh, I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah. But you could tell there are certain scenes where, like, Benicio roars, where you can tell they've digitally augmented it to make his mouth go a little wider. Because, okay, the restrictions of the makeup, he can only get his mouth so wide. And they really want that big dynamic roar. So, okay, we're going to augment this with digital instead of making a fully digital character and losing that tangibility. So I think it's really just filmmakers needing to, you know, as we were saying, avoid the thing of we're going to fix it in post and front loading a lot of the pre-production and going, okay, how is the best way to do this? If the best way to do it is fully digital, cool. Do it digitally. There's no inherent problem with that. But a lot of filmmakers nowadays, they will be given the choice of, well, you can do it digitally or you can do it practically. Which one's going to cost more money up front? The practical. Okay, well, then we'll do digital. And it's like, well, it's still going to cost potentially just as much, but you're saving that for the post-production. So you got to pick and choose those battles.
Oh, for sure. Now, tools-wise, we talked about Jurassic Park, we've talked about Terminator 2, and these were all massive leaps from practical to digital. And I know that had a lot of people scared. I know actors were a lot of them were afraid of being replaced by CGI characters. And I think a lot of practical effects studios were afraid of losing their jobs to CGI, which in some cases it has happened, you know, and you know, we're definitely not seeing the type of model making we used to see back in the day.
No, yeah. I mean, hell, looking at the Matrix trilogy, like, yes, everyone can look at The Matrix and go, okay, there's a lot of really innovative CGI technology here. But I don't think people realize just how many bigatures or big miniatures are there in that movie.
The battle for Zion alone. I mean, those
100%
amazing, like, miniature
there's,
work.
There's a shot work. In that movie where I think it's in Revolution where the Nebuchadnezzar, I think, comes blasting through, like, the doors into Zion. And that's a gigantic bigature. Like, it crashes, it does all of this kind of stuff. But, you know, but the Wachowskis were doing it right because they were augmenting it with CGI. Because obviously for a ship like you have all of the electricity pods, you know, that kind of help the ship to fly and do that. So they're already doing digital augments.
And fire to scale in the background, too, you know?
Exactly, because fire to scale is always a hard thing when you're doing these things in miniature, because fire is, it's fire. When it looks good, it looks good. But the second it looks even a little bit off, that's the one thing, like, everybody knows what fire looks like.
Yeah.
So that's the easiest thing to look at and go, okay, that's digital.
Yeah.
That looks off. And it,
talking about the fears of transitioning from practical to digital in these respects, I see a real parallel to the AI argument. Where do we land ethically on this?
Well, I think with the emergence of AI, I think it is kind of like what we've been talking about with doing it or using it to create something whole cloth versus using it to augment. I think, and I say this as someone who has not really dipped their toe into using AI all too much, but as a tool to kind of help with developing certain things, I don't inherently see a problem with that, but this idea of, like, with AI, using it to create something whole cloth, I think that's where you kind of run into an issue. The thing that practical effects artists were very worried about with CGI was, oh man, people are going to start creating these characters solely with CGI, and there's not going to be any practical creatures anywhere anymore. And once they realized that that wasn't really the case, like, the worry about it kind of dissipated. And you have some movies that are still big. I mean, hell, in super simple terms, we'll look back to Avatar. So you've got these giant creatures that are clearly all CGI, but you still have the very subtle practical effects on the scars that are on Stephen Lang.
Mm.
You know, so and it's like, you okay, so the practical makeup effects haven't gone away.
Mm-hmm.
It has just become another tool in the toolbox of the filmmaker. So I think that's kind of the big thing. So I think as a tool in the toolbox, AI is a powerful tool. But is it the tool? No.
No, no. Is CGI just like, the tool? Is practical the tool?
No. And that's kind of the thing. I don't think any of them on their own are the tool. Like, I've been a very vocal thing, because I'm obviously, like, I'm the kind of guy, and yeah, I'm biased because it's the department I'm in. But I'm always the thing of, like, if you can do it practically, do it practically. But I don't turn my nose up when someone goes, ah, but we can do a CG and do an add to it. It's like, cool, great. If that's going to bring the shot to where you want it to be, beautiful.
Do you know how many jobs I've talked my client out of hiring me for because I said, you could do this practically, you know, and here's how you could do it, X, Y, and Z. And they go, oh, wow, that would be really good. This is where my magician brain kicks in, because I want to create an effect that holds up for the camera too. You know, I had just spoken with a client. I was doing some consulting work on a film, and they said, okay, how can we add CGI fire to this scene? How can we add CGI smoke? And I said, well, I mean, honestly, if you just put a smoke machine behind that car and lit it, like, with a flame light, because that part of the shot is going to be completely out of focus in the background. Again, the importance of storyboarding and animatics, people. That's if you know what your shot's going to look like, you can plan how you're going to execute it. And you don't have to say, okay, we'll throw up a green screen on the day and we'll figure it out in post. Because that so many times people do that. Then they come to me and say, okay, cool, how do you do the effect? And I say, and then I look at it and I say, well, you could have done that practically on set, but I mean, I can do it too.
So. Yeah, and that's kind of the thing. I think any of these tools, treating them like the tool is where you kind of where people start falling short. But if you treat it like it is a tool in the toolbox, then you've got a better option. Like, you can't assemble a bookcase with only a wrench, right?
Yeah.
Like, you need a hammer, you need a screwdriver, you need multiple tools to do this particular thing.
If all you're carrying around is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Exactly. So and that's kind of the big thing, is that it's like, you just have to find the tool that works best for what you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's a combination of tools.
Yep.
You know, sometimes it's like, okay, well, I can get this in mostly with a wrench, but then I got to use a screwdriver to get it the rest of the way. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, okay, cool. Like, it's all about that free exchange of ideas and multiple departments coming together to craft that movie magic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because speaking as someone who knows magic, it's not just the magician doing the sleight of hand or doing the bit. It's the I only kind of know the terms kind of from the prestige, but you have the person who builds the effect. Mm-hmm. You have, you know, your person who's kind of the misdirection for the effect. Like, you have all of these different departments that have to come together to make the full effect work.
Mm-hmm.
And when you rely too heavily on one department, it could still work, but eight times, you know, it's like 9 times out of 10, it could also fall short.
I think the big takeaway from this conversation to me is communication and planning.
100%. Between every and all departments.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, if you're developing something on the day, like, can you do it in a makeup effect? No. All right. Well, what if, is it a costume effect that we can maybe use and get this done? Well, we can do part of it. Okay. Well, if we do that and then we talk to our digital guys and they can bring in an aspect of it, or, oh, we can communicate this with lighting instead of it's, so it's literally just finding these different departments. And that's why, you know, the best film sets are ones where you can tell it is a collaborative effort. That's one of my favorite quotes that I or like stories that I've heard when it comes to like James Gunn with how he kind of approaches filmmaking, is that he is not one of these directors who jumps in and is like, it's only my vision that's going to get this thing done. Like, he is very collaborative with his costume designers and his makeup artists and all of these different departments, and goes, okay, among all of you, how is the best way to bring this effect to life? And if it's solely one of them, cool, great. Most likely it's going to be a mix of a lot of them, though. And that's what's going to make that effect, that scene, that movie stand the test of time. Looking at like Jurassic Park, it's the mix of your practical puppeted creatures on set, the digital shots that give you the sense of the scale of these big creatures, the actors who are conveying the appropriate emotion, the sound design that helps you figure out, you know, I get a sense of the like how big this thing is, the lighting, which dynamically presents all of this to the audience. It's all of these elements that have to come together to create that perfect, beautiful magic trick.
Absolutely. And that's what this is. Movie magic, baby.
Exactly.
Well, Logan, I think we did it. We did exactly what we intended to do. I'm not sure what that was, but we had a wonderful conversation talking about the beautiful marriage of practical versus digital. Listeners, join us next time when we continue to peel back the onion of your favorite Hollywood films. I'm Jake.
And I'm Logan.
And this has been Hollywood Unveiled.